Your Humanities Half Hour is brought to you by the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.
Welcome to Your Humanities Half Hour. I'm Catherine Perry. Our guest today has been on our show before. Her name is Arlene Steffi, ethnographer and oral historian and research associate at Micronesian Area Research Center. Arlene, welcome to the show.
Half a day. How are you doing?
I'm good, and welcome back to Saipan. You're not a stranger to this place, are you?
No, this is home away from home away from home. My mother was born here. My mother is Federica Flores Santos. Her maiden name was Federica Pangilinan Flores. And her father, Francisco Agan Flores, was married to a bodic, an addict here before the war. And his first wife died, not as a victim of war, but something else. And then my grandmother, he left him widowed with... an infant son. And I believe Uncle Eddie might have been under 2 years old when my grandfather remarried. And my grandmother, born on Guam, was here for some novena, some activity, right?
Uh-huh.
You know how that is when the family comes over.
Right.
And so they were she was visiting, and he caught eye and sight of her and eventually got married. Now, she moved to Saipan, because my grandfather at that time had businesses here. He was involved in sugar plantation because one Ada, who was his father-in-law, they call him Bodik, one Bodik, had businesses as well. And I believe by the time my grandmother, my mother's mother, married my grandfather, they also had a bakery. She was a panadera here. They had bought a house that belonged to a Japanese, and my mother has described this to me in detail because I've been collecting her oral history. And for a sense of place, my grandfather was born in Palau between Narard and Netherlong on Babalda. And so we're heirs there, and we have property there. My mom's an heir to a very large estate in Babalda. And I believe if he still is mayor, your mayor, Donald Flores,
yes,
he's my first cousin because his father, Eddie, is my mother's half-brother. So my mom and her siblings, there are five of them. She's the oldest. The youngest is Jimmy D, was born here. And then I believe that my grandfather, Francisco's brother, Joaquin, still has children who live here. I know that Aunt Estefania Camacho, I interviewed the last time you and I spoke, I believe I interviewed her after I spoke to you, and still very alert, still very bright. I think some of her siblings have died off since, but I think she's still doing very well and not kicking. They have a longevity problem in my family. They stay around for a long time.
Is that a blessing?
Well, my mom is 81, and while she's very independent, living still, drives herself around and does very well. I think when you get to that age, you start to realize, I don't want to be around much longer if I can't take care of myself, if I want to be a burden. And that seems to be a kind of a theme that runs in, you know, Manamko. And I told my mom, I said, what are you worried about? I mean, we're going to take care of you. She actually wasn't sure whether we would put her in a home.
Aww.
Or take care of her. And my brothers and I would never consider such a thing. We are very grateful of what my parents have done to us. And it's just a natural thing to take care of her. You know, I mean, I know in the States it might be different because that's a cultural thing, but we certainly can take care of my mother. And maybe if financial situations were different, or maybe the care that was required, you know, if she was under some kind of medical treatment or something, it might be difficult. But just natural causes, you know, just natural aging, we're prepared to take care of mom.
Well, what an interesting story, and you obviously know your own family history very, very well, and that's really your life passion, isn't it? Knowing stories, learning people's stories, recording people's stories.
It would be a shame, wouldn't it, if I knew other people's stories more than I knew my own family. And I have to say that what drove me to ask about my family story was I remember being at the St. Anthony Church when I was about, I want to say maybe 12, 10 or 12. It was a family function. All the florists got together. And it was very different for me because I didn't know the history. But there was whispering around me about, and this is what I heard, her grandfather was murdered in Palau. And I didn't know they were talking about me. I don't know if you could hear what I said when I said that, but basically what they were whispering is her grandfather was murdered in Palau. Now, I happen to know at the time that my grandfather was not murdered in Palau, so I didn't think it had anything to do with me. The comment was incorrect. My great-grandfather was murdered in Palau. And so I did not realize at the time that they were speaking about me. And so fast forward this, my grandfather's brother, Wakin, comes to Guam. And I'm a little bit older at that time, and I'm listening to conversations with him and my mother, and come to learn that it was his father who was murdered in Palau. And this was during the Japanese occupation. And so, you know, I was like interested, but cautious. I really didn't know if I wanted to know about that.
Why?
That's what I can't explain. I was too young to care, maybe. I don't like violence as an individual. I don't watch anything. If it has any violent tone to it, I will not watch it. I am not fond of any physical altercations. I don't like combat. I don't support war. I just don't like it. It doesn't make me feel good. So when I was asked in 2003 to interview World War II survivors, I said no, because I don't like war. And I didn't understand then what it was going to be like and what was expected of me. I didn't know it would consume me. I didn't know that the baggage would transfer to me because my background in psychology and working with the probation, I knew that it's inevitable. It would transfer. So my hesitance was there. But I didn't understand from the journalistic part how it was going to involve me and how I was going to, as you said before the start of the show, be bitten. It is now all I do. It is something that drives me. And I didn't realize from a journalistic standpoint how historically important it was going to become. And so now, very seldom do I travel without my gear because I just never can tell where I'm going to be and whose story is going to become valuable based on, you know, what they did in their lives. And people don't normally think that what they've done is a contribution. But it is. It's like a domino. Everyone is doing something just like right now, at this very moment. How many people are moving around this island and how many people are doing something that tomorrow is going to be historic? They don't even think about it. But it's going to be. Even this show. So when we leave the moment we're in, it becomes historic in a larger picture. And when something occurs and they say, okay, what did Catherine Perry do on Saipan when she was alive? They're going to have to find everyone that you touched during your life. And they're going to ask those people, what did you know about Catherine Perry? And therein lies the story. So,
and that would be a totally different show.
Yes, it would be. But that's what oral history is. Now, the ethnography part of that, last night when I was when I canceled the show from jet lag, it wasn't from my jet lag from Guam. As you know, my husband and I just came back from Austria. And he's a full-blooded Austrian, but doesn't know anything about his homeland because he was born in the United States. And so my husband and I, for 30 years, have romanced the idea of traveling there. And so we now had the chance and went there and acted like locals. We didn't take a single cab. We didn't drive anywhere. We literally metroed with everyone. We went to the same sites. Everyone tried to eat where everybody ate. We really just tried to become Austrian. And I learned a lot about the empire, about the emperor and the empress. And very fascinating to learn about people. So their sense of place, the actions that they chose to do, the political realities that they were, you know, involved in, and their almost isolated lives because of the period. Their children were raised by other people. They grew up detached in a lot of ways. The father spent 18 hours a day trying to run an empire, a very difficult period at that time. And it made me wonder when I was reading the book, because that's another thing I do. I'm a avid reader. I read ferociously. If there's something to, if I have a minute to myself, I'm reading something. And so I decide everywhere I go, I'm going to grab a book that tells me a little bit about the place. And I will read that book while I'm sensing that place. And it helps me to remember, you know, things like that. So I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, man, what a period that would have been like to live. And I don't know about you, Catherine, but whenever I think about a period in my life, like when would I like to live backwards? It scares me.
Really?
That I'm living currently, yeah. Because we don't look at the social impact and how what is happening is affecting us or would be affecting our future. And I wouldn't never want to live during the cowboy days because I don't like the... I need a shower twice a day. I don't like the fact that they were that sparing in taking a shower. I wouldn't want to live during the war, because World War II especially, because I've learned of the problems that the Marianas had in being, you know, being that in that footprint and the being in that whole campaign. I wouldn't want to live in the beginning where there wasn't anything to do very much except, you know,
look for food.
Yeah, look for food.
And don't get eaten by any wild animals.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but we eat each other almost every day in a lot of sense. So there's always something at the expense. And life is so costly. You know, we do so much to preserve it, but we do greater to destroy it. And it's a contradiction in how man is. And so when I read these things, I keep thinking, when would I be happy living? And I'm grateful I'm living now, but I don't know what it's going to be like for other people. I mean, when would you like to prefer to live? What do you romance?
I had never thought of it, but you have. So
lots.
What have you decided as far as when you would like to live?
I'm glad I'm living now. Mm. I wouldn't want to go back. Mm. I would like to live future. I would like to live, like I said, I'd like to live in a place where there is no violence. I'd like to live in a place where people, very idyllic. I mean, maybe I'm very naive that way, but I really believe in getting along rather than fighting for everything, mm-hmm. fighting for positions. Why? It's such vanity. And I try to, you know, we teach our children. You mentioned a son the other day. I don't know how many kids you have, but we teach our children to be polite. We teach our children to get along and to consider other people's feelings, to share. And then somehow when they grow up, Catherine, it's a little bit different. All of a sudden, we teach them to be competitive. We teach them, you know, don't you see that? I mean, it's like, wow. You teach them thank you. You teach them excuse me. You teach them all those wonderful words and concepts to help them to relate to other people. And then he grows up and you teach him control and you teach him exercise of authority and you teach him competitiveness and you teach him aggressiveness. You have to be at the top and whatever. And it's like, no wonder they're so confused by the time they're early adults. And then, you know, they spend the rest of their life going downhill. It's too fast. Something is escalating too fast. And so my work, it helps me to pause. Helps me to look back. It helps me to rewind people's life stories and try to figure out when they were the happiest. And everything relates to being more physical in the histories I've collected.
What do you mean?
They're happier when they're doing something with their hands. They're happier when they're creating. They're happier when they're planting. They're happier when they're sharing. I mentioned to you the draft of the fishing oral histories that I just got back from our editor. And the thread in that work, in the collection of traditional fishing interviews, is that they were happiest not necessarily in catching the fish or in the method that they were using to catch the fish, but in sharing
in the community, working together,
in making someone happy. Yeah. Did you know that Catherine has a party? Here, go take this fish and give it to her. Mm. It's that contribution, that reciprocity that is so strong in the Marianas, and I'm sure it is otherwhere, but I live here, so I see it, right? It's like, my mali has something, or my cousin this, or my aunt that. Take something. We always want to contribute. And so when we're doing something with our hands, with the land, creating something, whether we're making a mat or stitching something, and then I bring it to you, that transference is a something positive, giving you, making you happy. That's when the highlight of being human and relating to each other really is experienced. And so I noticed that in the thread. I know whether it was a World War II survivor or whether it was even in the children in the giving of the land, passing off from the land, they were happier when they were doing rather than being idle. And rather than having to buy. When I interviewed Santiago Castro in Pagan, one of his dreams is to live the stories of his father and grandfather living in Pagan, uninterrupted life, not having to worry about how much food was going to cost, just going to the ocean, picking up a papangan or catching a fish and frying it, and only what they could eat for that day. Nothing stored, nothing hoarded. We have such a hoarding mentality today. You know, go to Costula's and buy a whole case, even if you don't need it for a long time. Then you're going to end up throwing it away because it expired. What happened is just buying what you need. Refrigeration in our fishing research, traditional fishing practices, we learned that in the introduction of the ice box, the refrigerator or the cooler, the attitude of the fisherman changed, because then all of a sudden he was going for the pound, mm-hmm. rather than for the catch. Mm-hmm. So the catch translated to the pound, translated to, you know, the size of the fish, and it kept increasing. He wasn't catching anything anymore to feed the family or feed the community. It was more about the vanity, more about the consumption base, you know, how much is this going to cost? And then there's this interesting guilt that I came across in fishing. They would sell it, and the fishermen were defending how they had to sell their catch. And they were not selling it to be rich. They weren't opening stores and feeding it. They were selling it so that they could afford the gas,
right,
to put in the boats to get back out and get some more fish. But people would criticize them for doing that. And you can't anymore just rely on the interior fishing. You have to go out for pelagic fish, because interior fishing was strained and stretched by the increase of fishermen. And then, of course, the demand. So just, you know, those are the kind of things I spend my time listening to and then writing about, or video, producing it in video. And I'm excited to get this one out, and hopefully the draft is finished. Our target was December, and that draft's finished. So hopefully in the next 6 months to a year, we will have a publication out on traditional fishing practices. And we included fishermen from Palau. We included fishermen from Guam, Saipan, Pagan, Luta, Tinian, and I think that's it. And a few women that were also fish. As a matter of fact, I just spoke to Captain Kelly Tenorio, Aiken Tenorio, and she lived in Guam for a little bit, and she also is included in this collection of fishing, because her father, well, talk about someone with an history. If you ever have time, talk to her. She was in Pagan when her father was imploding the reef there so that they could open Bandera Beach, so that when they build the Pantalan, they would be able to offload supplies. She was there when they imploded the, what is the area over here by that department store that closed down, a huge facility?
Townhouse? Sugar King?
No, over by the, what's the name of the suicide cliff? There's what's the name of the cliff on the top?
Suicide.
Okay, that's suicide. What's the other one?
Bonsai.
Okay, bonsai cliff. You talk to Kelly, and she'll tell you her father was worked for. I think it's the Department of. I can't remember. I want to say defense, but he was one of the guys that that would implode remaining ordnance from World War II. And when he collected it and they imploded it out there, it created a back wave mm-hmm. or back flood and literally engulfed them. And it was pretty dangerous, but she survived that. And when she was telling me about that, the implosion threw the wave back all the way to the bottom of Suicide Cliff. So if you can imagine that whole place being inundated with water, that was some of the work that he was, you know, he probably overcalculated the number of munitions that they blew up. But they did the same thing in Pagan. But in Pagan, it was to blow up the coral reef that was preventing ships from coming in. I don't know what the situation is now. When I was up there, the Pantalan was destroyed, so I don't know how they're able to get... I know they're still able to get in, but I don't know how far. Yeah. So just, you know, those kind of things, very fascinating. You learn these little tidbits about the history, and that's what I continue to do, so we're going to continue to publish these.
We're speaking today with Arlene Steffi, ethnographer and oral historian and research associate at Micronesia Area Research Center. We'll be back to talk about more of her projects after this break.
Happy holidays from the Northern Marianas Humanities Council. We want to say thank you for being our partner in 2013 through your participation in and support of our many outreach programs, including this radio show. We look forward to what 2014 has in store. Jesus Maasi and Kili Sol for navigating the human experience with us and for making our council your council. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you all.
Welcome back to Your Humanities Half Hour. We're speaking today with ethnographer and oral historian Arlene Steffi. Arlene, you're here in the Marianas this week, or the Northern Marianas, for a specific project. Tell us about it.
Itinautau Marianas, and that is the peopling of the Marianas, translated in English. We will be producing, or we are currently producing, a half-hour episodes, and we will be running these every Friday on KOAM starting March. And it's about the history and peopling of the Marianas. So anything that happened after, that we can tell, after the arrival of the Europeans in 1521, we can speak to with regard to the materials, the Spanish documents that have been left behind and the research that has been done. You interviewed Carlos Madrid just this last week, I believe. He's been here, and Hiro Kurashina. And these are the same individuals that I have to, you know, interview for their work. And Kurashina is a archaeologist. And so we don't have any written documentation of anything prior to European contact. But the archaeology and the summations that are made from that speak to a particular period of time when the original inhabitants of the Mariana Islands started to come and started to live, even if it was intermittent. And then when they started to bury their dead, when we started to see some kind of habitation. And so even though we have the Spanish scholars that can tell us everything that was written by the expeditions that came through, they can't tell us anything that happened before Mariana's history in that context. And so we have to go back and try to get a footprint, an idea, a picture of what life was before. And so that's where we look to the archaeology, and that's very, very important. The other model to consider is the genealogy. And the genealogy, I've interviewed another colleague of mine, Miguel Villar. And Miguel Villar has been working with Dr. Koji Lum on mitochondrial DNA. And I've shared in some of that project by collecting the DNA of roosters and feral pigs on Guam. And they were concerned about feral versus domestic because of the strain. But when I contributed to them, even that minor job work that I had to do, it was to be able to validate whether these animals were brought in to the Marianas with or before and where they came from. And so that's another clue as to where the people might have come from. So we're working on that, and then Dr. Vidal is working on the chromosome DNA, and that comes from the father. The mitochondrial comes from the mother. So we're going to be looking at a lot of where the peopling would have come from, or where the fathering would have been in relationship to the Marianas history. Because we know that the mitochondrial, the mother, has basically stayed. It's been generic to Guam and the Marianas. But the fathering was different. They're coming in from different islands. And so, different places in the world. And then there's the linguistic model. And with that, I've been talking to Dr. Lori Reed, because there are the models to determine the origin of a people are the linguistic, the archaeology, and the genetics. And so that basically tells you, or gives you a clue as to where the majority of the people came from in relationship to peopling. And so we're using that. And then also we're using oral history to be able to connect the living part of that model and a lot of the different activities, the social interactions, the food, the plants, you know, things like that. Anything that the people use, the diaspora, where they came from, even the Chamorros themselves left and then came back, or came back and then moved away for whatever reason, economic or otherwise. And so we're still seeing a lot of the peopling adjustments today. And so we want to be able to at least record that. So I'm here to interview your top guns in the matter of history. I've sat down with Scott Russell. Yeah, always a pleasure to interview him. And, of course, Sam McPheeters today. And I'm learning a little bit about the Micronesian aspect and connection because of the Carolinian relationship to the Marianas after with the reduction, when the Jesuits took the Chamorros, who were already inhabited and living in Saipan and Tinian and the northern islands of Gani, moved them down to Guam to catechize them and control them because they were, you know, on their own, and then moving them back into Saipan after the Carolinians had been living here for a while. And so I've been talking to Sam and trying to understand that aspect of it. Lino Olipai is not here, so I'm not able to interview him. So I may come back, you know, for a few of the Carolinian history from some of their people at some time.
As you said, this series, Peopling of the Marianas, is scheduled to be completed and ready to air in March. I have to ask, is there anything our listeners today can do to assist you with this project in any way? Because it's not just your project. It's not just a project from Guam, but it really sounds like it's a project for all of us.
I'm making it a project for all of the Marianas because it's about us. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a separate attitude about the Mariana Islands because my mother is born here. I feel that this is same. And because my grandfather was born in Palau, I don't feel any different there either. So I've always been very plural in as far as my attitude of the islands being connected. And so anybody who could believe that they can contribute to the historic elements of the peopling of the Marianas, please, you know, call Catherine or call me, 888-1010, and of course that's 671 if you call Guam. Or let Scott Russell know. I mean, I don't think Scott would mind, you know, fielding people and forwarding them to me, and maybe the next trip up here I will be here. I'm scheduled to leave Sunday night. So if anybody, you know, listens to it before then, I don't think, right, because they're going to run it Sunday. Okay, well, if they hear about it, even still, we are not completing the production by March. We are going episode by episode, and they're half-hour episodes, and we're going to do 52 of them for 1 year. So I'm collecting and producing as I run. Yeah.
Well, I have to congratulate you on taking on and making this very vast project possible, and it sounds like it's going to be very educational, possibly also something teachers can use in the classroom.
Well, the whole reason for this is similar to the impetus that Scott Russell found himself in that when he was asked to teach about Marianas history, there was no source materials. We're getting to the point where people are very confused about the history of the Marianas. We're confused about who peopled it first and who came first. Was it the chicken or the egg? And so the facts are there. The information has to get out. And we believe that doing it in video is going to be easier for the children. They're more video-oriented than they are book. And so we're doing it for them. We're doing it so that they would have a rich history, a clear understanding, because the last time I was in Tinian, they asked me what I was on Guam. And when I told them I was Chamorro, they told me I was not.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for taking time during your interview schedule to share your project with us. And
my
what's
pleasure.
Going on. We've been speaking today with Arlene Steffi, ethnographer, oral historian, and research associate at Micronesia Area Research Center. Thank you, Arlene.
Thank you, too.
This has been Your Humanities Half Hour. I'm Catherine Perry.
This program was supported by a We the People grant awarded to the Northern Marianas Humanities Council from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities or the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.